Chapter 1. Spirito Marzo believed in alchemy. He understood how a hard day's work could transform weather and soil and fruit to a fine Barolo or Barbaresco. He'd spent his boyhood among the mountains and valleys of the Piemonte, where tending the vineyard was a matter of course. Small, wiry, and jovial and as full of life as his name implied, he'd captured the heart of Clementina D'Urbiano, a no-nonsense woman who wore her dark hair parted in the middle and pulled back severely from her square forehead. By all accounts, theirs was a happy union, strengthened by a shared zest for adventure and rosy hopes for their children. In America, they believed, lay their fortune. Anything might happen in a place where people were creating light bulbs and phonographs and something they were calling motion pictures. And in the spring of 1902, the liner La Bretagne embarked from Havre, France, with Spirito, Clementina, and their two-year-old daughter, Luigia Ernestina, on board. Their timing was less than perfect. Spirito had imagined a future in lumbering, and they arrived in Latonia, Pennsylvania, to find most of its forests gone to coal mine construction, railroad ties, and paper. For a few years, he took what work he could at the remaining mills and the logging sites, until, lured by the promise of a better life in West Virginia, he packed up the family and moved to Richwood to work in a tannery there. The company house was just big enough for the growing family, but in the yard was plenty of room for games of tag and pom-pom pull-away, for a vegetable garden and grapevines trained up over the wooden fence. But by the 1920s, the hemlocks that had once covered the land in silvery green were all but depleted, and most of the West Virginia tanneries had closed. There was nothing for it but to pack their few belongings and sail, Spirito, Clementina, 10-year-old Peter, and baby Albert, for Italy. And there they made their home on a narrow street at the edge of the village, where snow-capped mountains rose in the distance and vines grew green in the sunshine. Luigia Ernestina had indeed discovered her fortune in America. Not for her, an alpine Italian village. She remained behind in West Virginia and took on the thoroughly modern name Louise. And she set about capturing the heart of a dark-haired young man from Sparks. Herbert Van Keenan had recently returned from machine gun duty in Saint-Mihiel and the Battle of Meuse-Argonne, and his American roots ran deep. His father's ancestors had been among the first tide of Irish in the 1740s, and his mother was a descendant of Abraham Le Mestre, a French Huguenot who'd arrived in Maryland as an indentured carpenter in 1661. Abraham's great-great-grandson Benjamin had served in not only the War of 1812, but during the Revolution, as General George Washington's courier at Valley Forge. And Benjamin's brother Joseph had been a part of the 13th Virginia Regiment at Brandywine and Germantown. One couldn't be more American than that, Louise decided. And as proprietor of an Akron speakeasy with a position with the post office in the offing, Van was assured of a fine future. In 1921, the two were married at the Methodist Episcopal Church in Webster Springs, West Virginia, and, thrifty and hopeful, were by 1960 able to send their youngest son off to Kent State University in Ohio. Mike, a star member of Kent's wrestling team, took his daily training run through nearby Hudson, past wide lawns and tidy lots, and the house where the Dover, Ohio chief of police lived. And one morning, he stopped running. In the front yard, quite minding her own business, was Chief Gridley's daughter, Judith. And when Mike sprinted toward the front walk, she smiled. He stepped into the yard and they talked, about his classes, most likely, and her hopes of landing a job one day, perhaps of the fun she'd had in her high school drama club, her love of singing, and the tap lessons she'd splurged on. After that, Mike called every morning at the white house with the black shutters. She was the prettiest girl in the county, he would remember. The baby with the big brown eyes and thick dark hair was born on the drizzly afternoon of April 17, 1964. They'd give him the middle name Herbert, they decided, after Mike's father and older brother. His first name would be James. Mike took a job teaching science at Indian Lake High School a few towns west, and the family moved into a two-story house flanked by flower beds and vegetable plots, with plenty of room for Mike's side business selling the pelts of animals he trapped and raised. Laced with trout-splashed rivers and dotted with shadowy forests where Jim imagined deer and rabbits might live, Indian Lake was an idyllic place to be a little boy. He raised his baby eyes to see a bald eagle soaring to its eyrie on Pony Island, listened to cicadas humming in the tall trees at the edge of the yard, patted his pet raccoon, tame as a house cat, and all his. Scarcely tall enough to see over the sill, Jim would stand at his bedroom window and watch his father plant peas and lettuce in the garden below.
I remember thinking, okay, if I crawl up in the window and if I get this screen open, I can get to that tree and climb down to him. I could see that what he was doing was taking a while, and he seemed to be struggling to get the shovel into the dirt. I tried to get up on the ledge of the window and realized, no, there's no way I'm going to be able to get to the window ledge to that tree safely. I could tell the distance from the window that the tree was too far. So I got back out of the window and just watched my dad. But I wanted to help so much.
As idols often do, the Indian Lake dream shifted to its dark shadow side. Judith eased her Volkswagen Beetle from the driveway and passed the Italian cypress that lined the front walk. She held her arm across Jim's middle when she braked at the end of the driveway. Whether Mike's preoccupation with sports had distanced him from his family, or Judith had had enough of opossums in the bathtub and a muskrat skinning area in the basement, the rift had grown irreparable. Divorce papers filed, Judith packed into the VW a few belongings and Jim's green Gumby erasers and his crayons, and pointed the car toward Interstate 71 and Hudson. Jim twisted in his seat and watched the house recede from view, hoping to catch one last glimpse of his father. Then he turned to his mother. "Doesn't he love us anymore?" he asked. He was 3 years old. Mother and son made their home with Grandma Gridley until Judith had set aside enough of her earnings from her job with Western Reserve Telephone to rent a place of their own, the rear portion of a farmhouse in Talmadge. Judith did the best she could to mask the smell of pigsty out back. She painted every room and worked away at that house to make it a home, her half-sister Pam would remember. She was like June Cleaver, always baking and cooking, doing whatever she could to be the perfect parent. Nonetheless, Jim would recall the house as dark and strangely empty, and the swine farmers living in the front rooms as less than nurturing caregivers. Charged with watching over him while Judith was at work, they thought nothing of leaving him alone while they slipped out to the movies. "She'll be back any minute," they reassured him, and left the 4-year-old to wait the eternity before his mother came home again. Jim slung a set of toy guns and holster around his hips, the way he'd seen Marshal Matt Dillon do on TV, or created swirling designs with his spirograph, one after the other, and no two alike. And at bedtime, Judith sat at the edge of his bed and read from Anderson and Mother Goose and his collection of little golden books about puppies and kittens and three little pigs. And she told him stories of her own, of her recurring dream that she stood on one leg, stretched her fingers toward the sun, rose with the wind, and flew over housetops and rivers and trees. Judith recognized Jim's artistic inclinations and brought home one day a small organ so he might experiment with chords and tempo and simple melodies. And Aunt Pam, only a decade older than Jim, became more a sister than an aunt. "I had a cheap guitar, and he was very interested in that," she would explain. "The first song he learned was Little Black Egg." On sunny afternoons, She'd climb with him into the shady cool of the oak tree in her parents' yard and read to him Bartholomew and the Oobleck. His pets were a cat and a canary, a combination that ended in tragedy and taught him early about competition and survival of the fittest. He seldom saw his father, but Mike remembered him on birthdays and at Christmas time, and faithfully sent Time Life books about Native Americans or biographies of inventors and industrialists, stories of men who'd struggled against all odds and persevered just the same. Jim looked forward most to holidays at Grandma Gridley's house, when aunts and uncles and cousins gathered to share stories of Christmases past and Grandma's sugar cookies. The real Christmas tree in the living room sparkled with tinsel and baubles, and on the top branches hung pipe cleaner candy canes and paper stars. "We'd make handmade ornaments every Christmas," Pam would recall. "Each of us made one for everybody in the family. One year, Jim made macrame Santas for me and my mom, and when he was really young, he painted a pine cone to look like Santa." On every street, one house becomes, by unspoken agreement, the place where children gravitate for hide-and-go-seek and tag and elaborate games of make-believe. The rambling ranch house on Hayes Road was the gathering spot of the neighborhood boys who became Jim's friends. Enclosed by a split-rail fence, its deep front yard was big enough for ball games, and the white barn just beside was an open invitation to explore its shadowy maws. The backyard extended all the way to the woods, full of mystery and adventure. When Judith remarried in 1968, they moved into the spacious house in Ravenna, a town of blue-collar workers lured from the Virginia hills by the steady paychecks and insurance plans offered by General Motors and the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in Akron. After a day on the assembly line, they'd drive the 20 miles home, smoke their way through the evening news and an episode of the Sonny and Cher show, or hee-haw, or laugh-in, then rise in the morning to do it all over again. For Jim and his friends, the house served as base camp for endless exploration and invention. Isolated in a pocket between highways and interchanges, and 3 miles from the center of town, the neighborhood was far enough removed to feel to them like a world apart. The small terrace surrounding the recessed flower bed in the side yard made a fine cockpit for a boy perched on the top step, the flagpole rising from the middle of the garden a perfect propeller post. From such a vantage point, the fields beyond were enemy territory concealing untold invaders or an Arctic wilderness just waiting to be claimed. The abandoned outbuildings behind the barn became bunkers and command centers where the boys reenacted movies like Kelly's Heroes and The Bridge on the River Kwai, or episodes of Hogan's Heroes, Jim taking on the Richard Dawson role. Trapdoors in the old chicken house were secret passageways where they could hide deserters and spies and stay out of sight of enemy eyes. Liberated from the classroom, Kirby and John and Teddy and Billy, who lived just next door, joined Jim in the barn on Friday afternoons and selected their allegiance, German or ally, or member of the French Resistance, and to formulate the weekend's battle plans. Strategies in place, they scattered home for dinner and reassembled after breakfast the next morning to resume where they'd left off. They dispersed across the field and into the woods, enacting their carefully crafted drama. They crept through the tall meadow grass, darting behind trees and the van in the driveway if they sensed the enemy nearby. The opponents might not meet again until Sunday afternoon, when they came crawling on their bellies from the edge of the woods to take each other by surprise. In a flurry of toy rifle exchange and excited shouts, "You didn't get me! I got you!" the battle was over in seconds, until it all began again the next weekend. In winter, Jim moved the combat to his room, one place he might avoid his stepfather and sudden paddlings with bright orange Hot Wheels track. He created elaborate narratives of quests and battles, skirmishes and rescue carried out by his collection of army figures and medieval knights and their steeds. Across the cellar floor, he constructed a vast landscape of castles and stockades, every miniature mountain range and bend in the river a setting for story.
Modeling clay was a block of nothing. Here was potential. You could create something from this nothing. When I was playing with the soldiers and knights, if there was some element of the story missing, a horse or a guy or a building, I would create it. My imagination could transform this amorphous block into something.
Ravenna officials couldn't quite decide to which school district the ranch house belonged, and in the first 6 years he lived there, Jim was assigned to as many different schools. No sooner did he make friends than he'd be shuttled off by Betty, the bus driver, to a new school. First grade, third grade, fourth, a continual adjustment to new teachers, new classmates, and confusion about where to find the lunchroom.
I was always introducing myself to new people. As an only child, I kind of lived in my head anyway, so I brought my friends with me, having many voices in my head. The glass half-empty view of this is isolation. But the glass half-full version is independence. I wasn't subjected to the hierarchy that had already been established with these kids who grew up together and who knew each other's faults and flaws and what they could do well. I wasn't pigeonholed into the established social order. Every time I had to make an important decision, I could rely on my own instincts. I could rely on three voices: my head, my heart, and my gut. No outside noise can penetrate a solid sense of self-trust.
Jim didn't aspire to be the most popular boy in class, or teacher's pet, or the one who got the best grades. His goal was to decipher the unspoken code the other children seemed intuitively to understand. They raised their hands and waited to be called on before they spoke. They formed orderly lines when they walked outside for recess, and knew the rules of the game when they stepped onto the softball field, all apparently without being told. None of it quite made sense to Jim, but he went through the motions as best he could, as if he understood the plan. And sometimes he defied the rules. One afternoon, while his second-grade classmates sat hunched over their penmanship assignment, he went to the pencil sharpener at the back of the room. Curious, he removed it from the wall and discovered inside yellow curls of wood shavings and bits of soft, black graphite. Impulsively, he smudged it across his upper lip and cheerfully goose-stepped his way back to his desk. His prank resulted in the first of many trips to the hall to endure a paddling from a paddling-prone teacher. After that, it seemed the slightest infraction, laughing too loudly, losing his place in his reading book, tasting paste, warranted the same punishment, and he soon gave up even trying to play by the rules. As soon as the morning bell had rung, he'd don another mustache or speak out of turn in order to get the anticipated spanking out of the way as soon as possible. Judith surmised her son might benefit from an activity both structured and enjoyable, and suggested he join the local Cub Scout troop. Perhaps swimming and building balsa wood airplanes and ascending the ranks with the other boys would help him develop not only social skills, but a bit of much-needed self-esteem. She drove Jim to his first meeting, and he joined the pack around the Formica kitchen table. The den mother brought the meeting to order and set a fat white candle in the center of the table. She lit it and informed the boys that when it had burned all the way down, she'd bring out cake and cookies and Hawaiian punch. If they misbehaved, she warned, she'd blow out the candle and they'd receive no treats that day. These were rules Jim could understand. He returned the next week, eager to learn all about camping and hiking and pinewood derbies. The den mother lit the candle, and almost immediately the other boys pursed their lips and began blowing gently toward the flame, delighting in its quivering dance. Jim watched them lean closer and puff harder until the flame went out. Young as he was bewildered and appalled by their self-sabotage. Feeling more the outsider than ever, He vowed that his scouting days were over, and worried whether he'd ever find the place he belonged, or recognize it when he did. Jim's grades were solid in every subject, but not exceptional. His teachers noted on his report cards that he lacked focus, but the personality inventories he completed in those years suggested two areas in which he might excel: the military and art. 3 times a week, Jim attended services with his mother and stepfather in a series of grim fundamentalist churches, each more devoutly self-righteous than the last. "It was horrifying to me when they started that," Pam would recall. "Once they came over to my parents after church. Jimmy was sitting on the sofa and doing nothing, not even talking. It was like he'd had a lobotomy. I'm like, 'Jimmy, what is the matter with you? What's happening? Let's go up in the acorn tree. Let's read.' Nothing." Terrorized as he was by the threat of eternal damnation, Jim was uneasy with the pervasive hypocrisy he sensed among the pious. He watched ministers weep upon the altar, begging forgiveness as they skimmed from church coffers. He heard them preach of purity, even as they imagined the next week's tryst with the deacon, or enticing some small boy into the sacristy. The congregations turned a blind eye to their pastor's crimes, believing absolution lay in accurately reciting Bible verses about the wages of sin. They cautioned Jim that his shortcomings, his less-than-stellar grades and classroom disruptions, marked him as a prime candidate for possession by Satan himself. Life on the playground was no easier. He tried to emulate the other boys, boys who knew that athletic success was one of the few tickets out of a place like Ravenna. They'd mastered bats and balls, and even strikes and spares long before, and Jim's was often the last name called when the two captains chose up sides for a game. But with third grade came Jim's first distinguishing achievement. Clad in a tall red hat and black pack straps crossed smartly across his chest, he appeared as a tin soldier opposite classmate Kelly Callahan in the school play Mr. Grumpy's Toy Shop. When Jim turned the key on Kelly's back, her China doll character was brought to life to dance on Christmas Eve with the Raggedy Ann's and Andy's and teddy bears that made up the rest of the ensemble. A small magic happened when he stepped center stage in full costume and character to play make-believe in someone else's story. Not long after, Betty, the bus driver, phoned Judith with the astonishing news that Jim no longer disrupted her route by burning holes in his math book with a magnifying glass, or singing too loudly along with the Fleetwood Mac tape in her 8-track player. Perhaps he'd changed merely because he'd turned 9. Or perhaps Jim's discovery that he could channel his gift of storytelling to productive ends left him with little time for mischief. The other 6th graders chose conventional topics for their end-of-year science projects, but Jim selected the Sasquatch. His presentation included a display assembled from pictures he'd found in magazines, and he retrieved the modeling clay from the back of his closet and created a detailed diorama of Bigfoot lumbering through the forest. More pseudoscience than fact, his elaborate project, his story, nonetheless impressed the judges and earned a blue ribbon. And at home, he packed up his knights and soldiers and cleared the basement to make room for a makeshift stage delineated by cardboard cartons and stray lengths of lumber. At one end, he set a portable record player and folded out its built-in speakers. He flipped through the Alice Cooper, Joni Mitchell, and Kiss albums Aunt Pam had introduced him to, and at last slid his Jackson 5 records over the spindle. Improvised mic in hand, he stood alone on the little stage, accompanying the Jacksons on ABC and I'll Be There. He gyrated his way through Dancing Machine, and sometimes, when he managed to hit the notes just right, he imagined his cabaret was real. The bare bulb in the ceiling, a colored spotlight, the music continuing long into the morning. Lights flashed in a pulsating strobe across the yard, and the wail of sirens echoed against the barn wall and over the field. Just inside the split-rail fence, Jim stood alone, watching the team of EMTs as they bent over the blanketed figure that lay motionless upon a stretcher. He looked up when Billy's father from next door approached purposefully from the shadows and asked what the commotion was all about. "I don't know," Jim told him. "My mom's going to the hospital." His curiosity satisfied, the man turned and walked back to his house, his own son safely asleep inside. He returned to his television and his recliner, leaving Jim on the other side of the fence, in the sound and the light and the darkness. Perhaps the aneurysm had been brought on by high blood pressure, and perhaps it had been a long time coming. Whatever the case, the vessel in Judith's brain had ballooned to the point of rupture. In the hospital, she suffered two more hemorrhagic strokes, leaving her half-paralyzed, half-blind, and unable to respond when Jim tried to talk with her. "You could see her struggling to make the word happen, but she couldn't say it," he'd recall years later. Few support groups existed in 1976 to help families care for someone in Judith's state. Her husband and son were on their own, and the counsel of their current church group was less than helpful. "She wasn't right with God," they told Jim. "That's why she got sick." They offered no assistance or listening ear, and took their good time deciding whether it was proper for Judith to come to church in the slacks she must wear over her incontinence pads. Judy had to wear some god-awful ugly shoes because she was paralyzed, and they gave her a hard time about that, too, Pam would remember. "After the stroke, I took Jim to their church, and the minister gave a sermon about how our blood was going to run 4 miles wide and 4 miles deep unless we came up and saved ourselves. So, of course, I took Jim and left. And I said that I would never, ever take him to church again."
"Though I did meet some wonderful people at those churches. People with a solid foundation of family and togetherness, they were caught up in dogma. It was my first brush with, 'fuck your church.' I knew in my heart that the universe was not that ugly, and that nobody's sitting in judgment. There's just shit that happens, and if we all help each other, we can work through it. I knew these people were wrong. What they were saying had nothing to do with what I was forced to learn in Bible study. It was weird, crazy judgment, and it made me not want to have any part of it. Even people in my family told my mother her affliction was God's punishment. Punishment by a God for your behavior is not one of the things on the list of how the world works. What fucking God of love is that?"
When one home health aide after another proved incompetent or unreliable, Aunt Pam stepped in to help with Judith's care. "I tried to make life as normal as I could," she would recall, "and Jim did everything he could for his mother. She was all he had." Jim shadowed Judith in case she fell, helped her bake cookies or her favorite maraschino cherry nut cake, buttoned her into her clothes, and loaded her endless laundry into the washing machine. He accompanied her to the bathroom. Often late for school because of his obligations, Jim suffered the taunting of classmates and scoldings from the principal when he ran down the hall to get to class on time. Yet school was a respite. He continued to earn good grades, and when the gym teacher introduced the 50-yard dash, he discovered a welcome release. He ran, and he learned he was good at it. His own speed rushing in his ears, he could focus on no one's performance but his own, forget for a little while the other boys and the teachers and the sadness waiting for him at home. And all the while, he'd find himself watching, as if just over his shoulder someone might appear, someone to catch his glance, understand an unspoken joke, ask to hear his story, and stand beside him to help rewrite it.